Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Evan Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
Hey, Tribe. If I was to give you $250,000 and you were interested in being an architect or a builder, what should I do? Well, we have some great conversations today with Phil Reed, the founder of Reed Thomas. And we talked through so many life lessons and so many things to facilitate technology into the art of construction. Phil is the co-founder of Reed Thomas, a BIM VDC consulting company focused on connecting designers, builders, and owners through cross-discipline technology integration. With over 20 years of experience in architecture and engineering, including 18 years implementing Autodesk Revit, the world's only fully integrated platform for the parametric design of buildings and infrastructure, his story is awesome. It's a little long-winded, but it's so much stuff I kept going with it. If you need to break this in, there's kind of two parts into the series. One, we kind of talk about his platform that has so many lessons learned, and then we switch gears and talk about offsite construction. So kind of a two-part deal that we're going to have so much fun and get to know Phil and his company, Reed Thomas. So let's dive in and have a fireside chat with Phil. Lock and load. What's your favorite beverage?
I like a cappuccino in Sydney, Australia, overlooking the Sydney Opera House in the morning. And I like a gin and tonic with barrel-rested Cardinal Gin from Gastonia, North Carolina.
I think you just gave the best story and painted the best picture when we say the speed round is getting to know somebody. And boy, he just said about his coffee in the morning and that in the afternoon. Great job. Phil, tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
Please, everyone, go to Singapore at least once.
And well, see tell what's us possible. One story of Singapore.
Singapore is like, Singapore is if a benevolent corporation built a country. And the benevolent corporation was run by Steve Jobs. It has the most extraordinary fit and finish where Singapore has come from. Read the history of Singapore, read the history of Lee Kuan Yew, and find out how that country went from dependence to independence from 1940 forward. Read about that. And then when you go back home to New York City and Chicago and LA and Atlanta and walk around our infrastructure and go, are we really a first world country? Because Singapore is doing something amazing. And they've come a long way in a very short time. They have the most extraordinary fit and finish. I think people have false opinions about Singapore. You know, the old adage about, oh, you can't chew gum in Singapore. I look at it this way. Nothing that you can do in a professional place of business. Well, there's lots of exceptions, actually. Lots of things that you can't do at work, you can't do in Singapore. So you can't throw trash in the middle of your office. You can't throw trash on the street in Singapore. You probably can't chew gum at meetings with professional, you know, customers. You can't chew gum in Singapore. There's lots of other reasons behind it. But the fit and finish of Singapore, I think, is actually, it's an edge condition about where political systems, healthy political systems, are headed that balance the self-determination of individuals with the entrepreneurism and sort of laissez-faire capitalism of a country that's only 5 million people, and they can make decisions and test things. It's fantastic. Go and see some of the most beautiful buildings in the world. Extraordinary fit and finish. Fantastic attention to detail. Yes, it's expensive to live there, but I think the quality of life is very healthy.
Awesome. What's your favorite hobby or interest outside of the construction arena we like to call the art of construction?
I don't watch a lot of TV, probably other than South Park and a couple of series on Netflix. I enjoy playing music. I probably would have been a musician, except you have to trust other flaky musicians to pay your bills. And then I studied architecture, realized that architects are flaky and you have to trust them to pay your bills. So I probably regret not going into music. Any other hobbies? I have a couple of old cars and I enjoy spending time with those and their family.
Awesome. Well, good stuff. Well, we got to know a little bit about Phil Reed, and I'm excited to go on this journey today and learn more about what he's got going on in his company, Reed Thomas. Can you give us a quick background of how we got here today to have this fireside chat?
Okay. The biggest thing that I did that was really, really important is I didn't borrow money to go to architecture school. And that's because I would get up at 3 a.m. in Northeast Charlotte, have a quick shower and a bite of food. And then I would drive to South Park, which is about 30 minutes away. And I would start work for this guy named Carlton Burton at Burton Engineering. He's still in business and I still buy him Christmas dinner every year. We try to have a drink every couple of months or so just to catch up. And I worked in a civil engineering firm while I went to architecture school. And the result of not borrowing money to go to school meant when I got out and started working in the architectural profession, when Revit came along, I could take a chance. And if there's anyone young out there that is in college studying architecture or getting ready to go to college, please find a way to do it without borrowing money. You don't have to go to the premier architecture school or the premier construction school. You can learn an enormous amount online. You can learn an enormous amount anywhere in the world. Do not borrow money. And when you get out, you don't have to take the first shit job that comes along. So from that, I went to a little startup called Revit Technology. I thought the technology had a long way to go, but it was amazing. And they had a team that was experienced with regard to going to market. Actually, the senior team came out of a company called PTC, which is a mechanical parametric company. And they had founded that technology. And I went to work for Revit. It was amazing. I had, as a matter of fact, yesterday was 18 years to the day that I started with Revit Technology. And I worked under a suspiciously kind and gracious manager named David Heaton. And David, he would listen. He didn't have an agenda. He would say, what do you think works? Give me some options. And we would talk about things. And he would say, what do you think is the best way to do it? And I would say, I think it's this. And he'd go, well, let's do that then. And you let me know if we need to change it. Like if we'll learn something, we can change direction. That was an uncommonly unique and positive experience. Being purchased by Autodesk first gave me a lot of concern because I'd heard all these stories in the industry about the big, you know, the 800-pound gorilla. It turned out that the Autodesk seal of approval is what really helped Revit to succeed. And so then I was working in the consulting group. So without exaggeration, for the last 3-4 years at Autodesk, I was traveling 48 weeks a year on site with customers, working with every firm I would have dreamt of working with while I was in architecture school, the firms that I so deeply admired and had the opportunity to work with them and understand how they work. Without having to deal with a lot of the politics of actually being an employee. So that was an extraordinary experience. But as the kids got older and fast forward to 2008, went to work with a large A&E firm. I just couldn't keep traveling so much with Autodesk and I didn't know what else I could do that would, I really didn't know what kind of transition I should do internally at Autodesk. So I just probably a bit in stress mode. I took a position at another large A&E firm, and that was an extraordinary experience in understanding the kind of nose to the coal face of how politics work in large organizations, and some of them are positive, and I think some of them are very negative. So eventually went into another startup, which was a different experience than having worked at Revit, but learned a lot there. And then in 2013, started my own practice out of sort of, you know, the lessons learned. The trick is not learning from your mistakes, Devin, as we were mentioning earlier. The trick is learning from some other poor bastard's mistakes. And so I did learn from some other poor bastards, but I learned a lot from my own. And you just have to forgive yourself and go forward. So in 2013, started a company called Reed Thomas with a business partner that's about 20 years younger. And he has an architectural degree and a background in construction and his MBA. And our goal is to facilitate the use of technology from design through operations through really good and unique lessons learned.
Awesome stuff, man. So to recap your intro is that you've worked in the field working with Revit and other amazing tools, and now you're running your own company. And the kind of mantra that you've been talking about is learning from others and don't go leverage yourself into maximum debt and get stuck in a place where you feel like you have to versus getting out and do what you're really passionate about. Is that a good recap of that?
Yeah. So the biggest challenge is that I think, you know, from the time that people go to university, they get into debt. And that's an enormous show in itself, because I think it's indentured servitude. The way that the student loan cabal is set up right now, you cannot declare bankruptcy. So if you earnestly go to college, study something, can't get a job doing the thing that pays your bills, you cannot declare, you cannot get out of that debt. And so I would encourage people not to go to expensive schools. Go to the cheapest local state university, pay your way through, you know, work part-time such that you have enough time to drink, but not too much time. And you have enough time to spend, you know, time with your friends. That's important, but not too much time, because it is an unrecoverable lifetime of debt. Just to give you just a numbers example, and I can talk about numbers and in terms of investment about this. If somebody put $250,000 on your kitchen table and you're 18 years old and said, what do you want to do with this? And you said, I want to study architecture. And they said, okay, here's $250,000. That's going to give you $50,000 over 5 years, $60,000 over 4 years, and you can now go to architecture school. If you had taken that same $250,000 and invested it in any early 2000 technology company, you could already be done. You would be retired. So why would you take that money to go to architecture school? Unless you can go to architecture school really, really cheaply. And that is, I think, if you get behind that unrecoverable debt, you're stuck. You're stuck working for companies, doing things you don't enjoy, with people you don't enjoy working with, because that debt will haunt you. So not borrowing money is, I think, just the most important thing for a young person to understand.
Awesome. And I'd love to just piggyback off of that. As people say, kind of Devin, as a serial entrepreneur, the Tasmanian Devin, how are you able to fast track so many different things? And a lot of that is when I went to a great smaller school, had a lot of friends, and my dream was to come to Colorado and go to CU. And I looked at the cost ratios, and I actually went to school in Grand Junction at CMU, where I ran a lawn mowing company called Cutting for College and ran the rugby team. And I was able to have plenty of partying, plenty of fun, learning how to run a business. But what was really cool is those guys in the rugby team working in my lawn mowing company, I was able to write a check for college. And then after college, my parents did a great job raising me. And they said, Devin, you go to whatever school you want, and you give me the diploma with the bill at the end. And so I was able to pay cash. And then my parents, you know, I was the first in my family to graduate college, and all, you know, the rest of my family has followed behind me. And my stepfather that raised me, who's my boss's boss in the construction world, wrote a check for me that then he also helped me. That check we used was to purchase a house. And so those things, to buy real estate and build your business, I couldn't agree more. That was how I was able to fast track and not be leveraged when I was building my local business and my global megaphone. So thanks for sharing that. And that's definitely something that I'm passionate about, is I'm here to help you grow your business. It's really hard to grow your business if you're strapped from a certain decision or thing that you've made. And there's a lot of upcoming superstars that are part of the AOC tribe listening to this. So hopefully that's gold that they can take home and have us to be a platform to help them. So let's
I tell my kids lovingly that inside the walls of the house, they are special and unique snowflakes. And then when they step out that door, they're a line item on somebody's Excel sheet. And what you just talked about, it is so important to learn to hustle when you are young, to be accountable to someone. Like, you think, oh, cutting grass, working McDonald's, working a coffee shop, you know, those are jobs that are below. Well, you know what? When you have to show up to cut grass, hey, it's going to rain. You don't show up and cut grass now before the rain comes, and you got to wait a couple of days, and now you got overgrown thick grass. You got a problem. So showing up for the customer, being accountable, that is a lesson that you can't underestimate the value of when somebody is young. Because I think this, I suppose some people disparage the sort of millennial generation, but they're growing up in ease. They're growing up with the internet. They're growing up with information at their fingertips and convenience at their fingertips. The downside of that is, are you learning to hustle? Are you learning that you have to be personally accountable, and that you will not be paid based on the money that you've borrowed, that you will not be paid based on your debt? You're paid based on your replacement value. And so the student that gets out of technical college, where it's a couple thousand dollars a year to go to technical school to learn a technical trade, like to learn how to use CAD or to learn how to use Revit or to learn about construction from a technical college, is a minuscule debt, and you learn to solve a problem in 18 months. If you go to architecture school and study for 4 or 5 years and you get out, you're paid the same amount or less than someone who's gone to technical school for 18 months. Is that fair? I don't care. Your replacement value coming out of architectural school is very low. Your replacement value coming out of a technical program, which you may want to leverage into going to architecture school, is very, very high because you can solve problems. So good on you. You learned how to take rugby players that needed to stay fit and put them behind a lawnmower. Well, that's a good fit. And then you could pay them, and then you could pay your own way. And then you're learning to be accountable to customers, and somebody's not happy with how their grass got cut, and you have to get on the phone with them or go and see them and have an uncomfortable conversation. That isn't a, you have to learn to do that before you're 20 if you want to be successful.
Yeah, the art of hustle is, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you better be able to do that, because two things we don't have enough of is time and money, and we always talk about that. And there was times when my lawnmower broke down, and I had to stay there and not go to the party and get that lawnmower fixed, and boy, I was ticked off at the time, and I was like, this sucks to be in charge.
Yeah.
But now looking back on it, it's like those lessons learned were so valuable. And
yeah, you dodged a bullet.
And that's the school of hard knocks, not the school of theory and practice. And that's what I want to kind of go in with you today is talk to. When I was researching your awesome company, Reed Thomas, I loved the three kind of, your website is really simple to understand, but there's the words in those simple website can be kind of complex. So the three things I want you to kind of talk through are contextual implementation, real-time simulation, and customized development. So let's start off and say why those three things, and then we'll go into those three buckets that make up Reed Thomas.
So let's talk about contextual implementation first.
Let's do it.
So 90% of the AEC industry is firms of less than 10 people. 90%. If you work for a firm with 100 people, you're an edge condition. If you work with a firm that's 1,000 people, that's an extraordinary edge condition. Most of the firms statistically are less than 10 people. 10 people cannot stop what they're doing and sit in a room for training for a week and pause all of their work and learn how to do something. So one of the things I learned working with Autodesk is, I mean, obviously Autodesk focuses on large firms. They have, you know, Autodesk is a multi-billion dollar company, and they can't reach down into the market of 90% of these small firms. The challenge with small firms and learning to do something is they can't stop what they're doing to learn how to do it. And it's not a fault of theirs. It's the fact that people don't have, they're not task driven in small firms. They have to overlap a lot of tasks. So what we focus on with small firms, the way we approach training is, I was really fortunate to write the Mastering Revit series, to co-author the Mastering Revit series with James Van de Zandt and Eddie Kriegel. And that book was really, really successful. It was translated into a lot of languages. And for good reason, I don't use that book to train people to use Revit, because that book will use examples from the world that always work, because they work because we design the chapters around pieces and parts of buildings that we are familiar with. And so everything in that chapter is going to work. And then what happens in the real world is your building is different. And so you want to learn how to use Revit, which at a high level is sort of a platonic abstract, but you have to immediately apply it to your project, and you have a deadline today or tomorrow. Large firms with really big projects have the ability to create a pipeline where they can suspend those kind of deadlines in order to put a team or a couple of teams of people in a room to do training. And small firms can't do that. So the way that we like to approach training, whether we can do this remotely or we can do it on site, we can save a lot of money by doing it remotely, but the training is done live. We're not pre-recording anything. And we take a concept that is based around the project that they have to deliver. So we like to wait until the design calcifies a little bit. Sometimes firms will use, they'll use hand sketches, they'll use SketchUp, and they get to a point of resolution where it makes sense to start in Revit. And then we'll build a training program around their project. And the only requirement that we have is pick a project type that you're familiar with, because if you try to use new technology on a new project typology, it's just overly stressful. And don't pick a project just because it's small, because small projects tend to have a million things that happen once in them, where larger projects tend to have things that happen many times. So there's some value in the scalability of doing a project that's actually larger. It's actually easy because there's repetitive things that happen in those kinds of buildings. And we'll do a little bit of training in the morning, no more than 2 hours, maybe an hour and a half. and we'll go through a concept of either, are we working on the building? Are we working on the content of the building? Are we working on documentation? Or are we focused on multi-user workflow? And we'll do an hour, hour and a half of training, and then we will get on the project with you and help maintain the deadlines. Now, during that morning, there's going to be a lot of questions, and it's not efficient to be peppered with questions and everybody stops and you think about it and then you start again. We go, okay, let's collect all the questions, keep working on something else. And then after we've had lunch, we're going to talk about this list of five things. We're going to go through what we need to train on for that afternoon. And that's how we help deliver projects. And what happens is, I mean, our rates are such that the architectural team can bill us through as part of the production team and generate revenue. So that's how small firms are able to justify training, increasing their knowledge base with Revit. And the nice thing I like about it is there are firms that you have never heard of in second tier, third tier, fourth tier cities doing the most careful and precious and thoughtful, earnest design work. And you're working with teams like that. And it's extraordinary. Firms you've never heard of, small teams, three, five people doing the most careful, beautiful work and working with teams that care about their design. They're doing careful, beautiful work is just really wonderful. So coming up with a training mechanism that actually pays for itself and taking away team stress and giving them this contextual knowledge. Because if you just say, build a curtain wall based on this example, it's like, it's not their curtain wall. It doesn't have to do what their curtain wall does. That's not useful. It's not contextual. And so that's how we approach it.
Great stuff. And this is where I really would say, this is where you got to step out of your business and work on your business. But what Phil's team has done is they're one of you. So they know how this stuff works. So they can really drive, you know, real support. So when we talk contextual implementation, that's their training program, if you will, where they work with project support, content creation, BIM workflow support, and project modeling. Is that kind of recap when we talk about contextual?
Yeah, you know, the thing about Revit, the thing about buildings, the way that I conceptualize it is there's the building. And in Revit, those are system families, walls, floors, roofs, ceilings. Then there's the things that go inside the building. There's doors and windows and furniture and fixtures and equipment. And then there's the instructions of assemblage. Those are details. When two things that are different touch, how do you connect them together? So we focus on the building. We focus on the content. We focus on the documentation. And then even in a small firm, you usually find that people tend to gravitate towards, am I working on the overall at the macro level of the building? Am I working out the kind of the you? There's, I think, I was actually talking with Anthony Hawk. Formerly with Autodesk, he's now in startup mode. Anthony said something really interesting about buildings in that the user interface, the UI is the building, but the UX is the interiors. And I think people, that was like a really great thing that Anthony expressed in such a simple way, because we talk about UI and UX. So there's people that focus on the sort of UI of the building, and then there's people that focus on the user experience of the building, and then there's people that focus on the instructions of how two different things have to connect. And then the overarching piece is just work sharing and workflow. How do you sort of organize the information so that people can get to what they need to do quickly and make changes and update it? And so when I've always broken it down like that, there's the building, there's the content, there's the documentation, and there's workflow. And it's not any more complicated than that, you know, from a technical standpoint. And so that's how we approach it with firms. But instead of training them on some abstract building that's going to work perfect inside of a, you know, 1200 page book, we go, what kind of building are you designing? So we're working with a team right now. We're getting ready to start to work with a team that's doing a series of medicinal dispensaries. And we go, this is great. You've got six of them. They have the same pieces and parts, but they'll be assembled differently. What do you need to learn? It's like, well, we have to make custom content. Well, then let's make custom content. Send me some of the drawings and the sketches of what you guys intend to, like this custom content, and it has to be built. So let's teach them to make a Revit family, a piece of casework based on their specific project. And then it's real to them.
Awesome. So the next bucket that I want to talk about is real-time simulation. Can you expound on that for us?
Yeah, and it's probably, you know, that's a word we probably chose back in 2013. I think the big issue is that we have ourselves in a position technically where we want to understand the implications of a design decision as quickly as possible. And you can call it real-time visualization. You can call it real-time simulation because the technologies are getting very complex. You know, you can actually simulate things like weather and crowds and activity and events. I think really what it's about is just understanding the experience of that project before you've spent the stress and time and money of building it, because you learn a lot about unintended consequences when you either visualize or simulate or experience that project. And this leads into the third piece. I'll sort of deviate from this. I think if you're going to get into real-time visualization or real-time simulation, there's a multitude of tools. There's probably a dozen that I could talk to that do very, very useful things. The ones that solve the problem for us that I really have an affinity for is a little company out of Germany that's created a technology called Enscape. And Enscape renders your project live as you work. And the value of not having to push an export button or an update button cannot be underestimated. I mean, it's just wonderful to see the implications of a design decision the moment after you've made it. I think the Unreal Engine, if you're going to get into gaming engines and you're young or you want to look into gaming engines, the Unreal Engine is extraordinary. You will encounter an enormous amount of unrecoverable workflow, and you may not enjoy working 80 hours a week when there's a deadline and you have to change things. And if you haven't federated your Revit model properly, it's very dysfunctional. But the Unreal Engine is capable of extraordinary simulation. And so I think those are the two extremes where for us, the Enscape environment is what we just use 99% of the time. The moment you get past pursuit visualizations and you don't even have a Revit model, you're just working in Max or something, then I understand why people use game engines. But after you get past that very early marketing pursuit simulation, you're just trying to solve problems and you want to see the results of that problem. Enscape, I thought it would be mostly used by architects because it's highly visual and very, it appeals to the vanity of understanding how a space is lit and materials and fixtures and furnishings, and it's very immersive. And then lo and behold, mechanical firms started to buy Enscape, and I called them up and said, what's going on? You guys are building plant and process environments. And they said, yeah, we don't really care about whether something's beautiful, but we don't want to kill people either. And so being able to walk around a dense plant and process environment and actually see our skid-proof materials on surfaces, can you actually see signs and egress instructions in a low light condition if there's an emergency? And they're finding out that just because it's correct on a set of drawings, you can even get things approved, but the experience of that building will not meet safety conditions. And then contractors start buying this thing called Enscape. And that surprised me because really it's not, there's no built-in clash detection inside of Enscape. It's just visualizing what's in your Revit file or SketchUp. Now Rhino and ArchiCAD are also plugins. And the contractors, very simply put it, there's lots of clashes that aren't problems, and there's lots of problems that don't clash. And they want to see fit and finish level of detail. They want to see grout lines. They want thoughtful, meaningful instructions from the architect. And they want to walk around and experience the space in order to find problems that you don't see in plan and section elevation. And Revit's a wonderful design coordination tool. Revit's not a very easy tool to explore. And so I've had situations with contractors and engineers that are immediately suspicious and they want to try on VR because it's this new thing. And then they open up we say, bring their project over. We'll go downstairs in our meeting space in Charlotte. Bring your project over on a thumb drive. We'll open it up in Enscape and you can walk around in VR. And the very first time this happened with an engineer, he was as chatty as I am going, yeah, I don't see the big point of this, but it's kind of new. And, you know, my boss wants me to take a look at it. So we open up his project, we push the start button in Enscape. He puts a headset on and he starts looking around. And within 15 seconds, he went, well, shit, that's not going to work. And we're kind of laughing, going, what are you talking about? And he goes, I've been staring at this model for months inside of Revit, and I just realized we got a problem. And so it's that kind of experience where you can understand the implications of a design decision immediately. That's just incredibly valuable. So that's the piece around simulation and visualization. And then the last piece is custom development. And I think there's really two parts there. Devin,
I'm going to stop you there before we go to custom development. Yeah, I just want a couple of highlights there that just really, you know, I just want to thank you for that example, because I got to raise my hand and say, you know, I'm the leader of the AOC tribe and the art of construction's job is to connect the dots. And when I go down the vein of the AEC community and going to Autodesk University and these different places is very different than going to the International Builders Show. And I'm trying to connect those two and put them together. And when you talk about game engines, I just have to raise my hand and say, can you give me an example of that? Because Enscape sounds to me like the one that's actually working when you put the goggles on, if you have designed it in Revit or ArchiCAD, if I'm understanding you right. And what we're talking
about Revit, ArchiCAD,
are the different tools. It's something you can actually use through this Enscape versus there's other tools that are really struggle to make that work.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody else, and it was just the way the technology worked, is that you designed and then you pushed a button and waited. And so that happened with rendering. That happened with AutoCAD. That happened with early BIM tools. You would design in 3D, push the button, export, wait, and then you go to your documents, or you push the button and wait and create a rendering, or you push the button and wait and create an animation. The weird thing that happened with Enscape is, you know, I'm old and curmudgeonly, and when my business partner, who's young and optimistic, said there's this company that's going straight from Revit through the GPU and rendering in real time. And I thought, oh, bullshit. No one's going to do that. Like, the AEC space is tiny. Go do that for the medical space. You know, make $1 billion over there. And then I started digging around online, and lo and behold, Brian Mackey had a post in one of the Revit forums that said, oh my God, Enscape, take my money now. And when I looked at the technology, I was shocked. Now, it had a ways to go, but going from Revit through the graphic card and visualizing live, the next thing I did was call the CEO and said, you have an extraordinary opportunity here, and I would like to help you go to market. I worked for Revit Technology. I worked for Autodesk. I know all the customers that you want to meet. And he was very gracious, but he said, you know, it's not expensive. It's easy to buy. You just swipe your credit card, and it's easy to use. Why do we need any, like, sales and support people? And I said, oh my gosh, you know, the person that wants to use this is three generations away from the person that approves the purchase. So it's not easy to buy. Technically, it's easy to buy. In practice, it's not easy to buy. And then number two, they're not going to have many questions about Enscape, but my goodness, will they have an enormous amount of questions about how to do something in Revit so that it properly shows up in Enscape. And I'm that guy. And so we partnered with Enscape in late 2015 as they were really starting to go to market. And I am so honored to be supporting Enscape anywhere around the world. We have customers, and I got there early because I had valuable customer relationships, having worked for Revit and then worked for Autodesk. And so we earnestly support Enscape anywhere in the world. And if a customer wants the best experience using Enscape, I go, send me an email. Let me help you out. Because we understand the stress of your deadline. We understand the stress of your workflow. And I want to help you come up with a solution and use Enscape so that it becomes seamless and that you get a sense of joy from using this technology. But it's what they've done is unique in that you're going straight from the design tool through the GPU and rendering it on a second screen live. You're not pushing an update button. You're not pushing an export button. And I think that's where the other tools have struggled. They were the best solution at the time, but now you don't have to do that.
I love that. And I have to explain the core values of the Art of Construction in my sister companies is do the right thing, problem solving, get shit done with a commitment to excellence. And those four things, I bring those core values up because when I hear a Phil, my aha moments are jumping out to say, he's not selling Enscape. He's passionately leading Enscape, and it's a way to get stuff done with a commitment to excellence. And that's the problem in our world of that there's so many of them that you have to hit a button and render, 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 and then it pops up with the exclamation mark of doesn't work or problem this.
Oh,
and then you have the deadline.
You just forget things.
You know?
Yeah. So, you know, in Enscape, when we first started working, I think, you know, as a technology company, and believe it or not, none of the Enscape team is trained as architects. None of them understand, like, they never went to architecture school. They have just built a beautiful tool for building design. And they said, well, so what you want to do is be a reseller. And I said, no, I don't want to be a reseller. I want to be accountable for the support of every customer that comes to us. So if a customer purchases Enscape through me or my company, I am obligated to be the boots on the ground support for that company. And we don't charge for it. And 9 times out of 10, the questions are not about Enscape. They're about SketchUp or Revit or some workflow in the design tool that is idiosyncratic and not easy to use. And because we have this background of deep understanding of Revit, a lot of times it's just questions about things that Enscape maybe wasn't meant to do. It doesn't have a button for it, but hey, if you know how to use Revit well, have you tried this? That's a happy customer. That's somebody who's, I think, honestly, it's about giving people a better life experience. They don't just want to be architects 24 hours a day. They want to get out. They want to meet with friends. They want to experience the life that helps to make them passionate designers. And if you're just stuck behind your desk all the time, it's hard to really enjoy architecture. And so if you can help them get out of the office by doing something beautifully and elegantly, that to me is just like, that's what I really love doing.
That's so cool. And you're not selling a seat of Enscape. Or we just interviewed Bill Allen, the founder of Evolve Lab, as we're taking lives. And he's like, I'm not here to just sell a seat of Revit. I don't want to be stuck into a box. It's an amazing program. And that's where I've built my platform, but it's not for everything. And that's why with the Art of Construction, we just launched the AOC Lab, where we want to be a technology concierge, where I've had the pleasure of meeting over 100 people doing these fireside chats with teams like Phil's team. And as you start connect the dots and you listen or guide these different stories, it's not about being in a box. It's about being in this open platform and being able to solve the solutions to that project, and more of a bottom up than a top down and shove it into a box. Is that kind of
no, Devin, I tell you that the industry, the solutions are too broad. They don't come from one software company. They don't come from one ecosystem. And the value is not in the software. The value is in the solution. If you want to save a lot of money, don't buy software, use a pencil. And the pencil will even put you out of business. If you're an inexperienced lawyer and you're drafting legal briefs with a pencil and you get it wrong, it has nothing to do with a pencil. It's that your thinking is not good. And in the architectural space, if you have extraordinary tools, tools are just hammers. And if you don't know how to use a hammer, if you're a dumbass with a hammer, you're a dumbass with a nail gun. And you're probably a dangerous dumbass with a nail gun. So the value and the tools are going to change. The tools are going to evolve. But the trusted relationship of being able to de-stress someone and explain how to use the tool properly in the context that they need to solve a problem. And our value is not just knowing how to use the tool. Our value is knowing how not to use the tool, because you can do things 10 different ways in Revit, but in 2 months' time, an experienced person will say, this thing is likely to change based on this condition. So I'm going to show you how to do it in Revit so that in 2 months' time, you can change it in a way that you didn't know that you needed to change it. That value, that's not a fly-by-night consultant. That is somebody who can save you days and weeks and hours of unrecoverable workflow by using a tool, you know, using a tool accidentally to do something today because that's what you saw on a YouTube page or that's what you read in a book. And then in 2 weeks, there's a major critical path revision and you have to meet the same deadline. And you're like, oh my gosh, I built this thing in such a Gordian knot. It is so untangleable. Whereas if you just had somebody work with you a little bit, that's going to cost you money, but it's going to cost you so much less time and aggravation than doing it accidentally. And that's all we're trying to do. And the customer's not coming to us to say every solution has to come from one software company. That is just untenable. And I, mind you, I so much enjoyed working for Revit. I so much enjoyed working for Autodesk. I pay my bills and help my kids go to college because of Autodesk's wonderful software. But Autodesk wonderful software requires beautiful, wonderful hardware, and it requires lots of other tools that Autodesk doesn't have answers for. So how are you going to help your customer if, you know, you got to get out of one ecosystem and look at the big picture?
It's gold, man. I appreciate it. So I keep stopping us because there's so much good stuff, but this conversation is so timely of where, you know, where the Tasmanian Devon is of guiding this and trying to look at it from a third grade level to say, I don't want to go to college. I want to know it now. And the best ideas are borrowed and executed. So much great stuff. So the other thing is customized development. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I know you bounced, you know, of our
three buckets. No. Okay. So customized development, the big picture there is there is an enormous amount of useful, valuable technology that is developing around this BIM ecosystem. And I don't just want to anticipate the explosion of these useful tools. My company wants to facilitate it. So here's the challenge. You and a couple of smart people, you work for a big company, and you go, you know what? If this tool did this thing, we could save a lot of time and money. We could sell it. We could make more money doing that than we're making at our company doing design work. So they leave, or they start working part-time on a tool. They build a website. They put it out there. And I promise you, if you build a better mousetrap, the world does not beat a path to your door. It's not about technology. It's about the team. It's about business continuity. And if you're a large firm, well, if you're a small developer and you want to, you know, the dream is to sell your technology embedded into a large firm, and the sales cycle for your tool is enormously long. And the risk aversion of a large company, not that they're going to use your technology, the cost of the technology is trivial compared to the cost of changing behavior. And so they have to look at the technology and go, how are we going to implement this? How much does it cost? Is our competition using it? Who else is using it? We have to implement this change strategy. And then this team of four people, what if they go away? Like, then what are we going to do? And so what I sort of accidentally realized is the value of helping people solve problems is not just, you know, the end user of technology companies that are well established. I would love to meet a small team that can show up on time and get their shit done. But what they've realized is they make a phone call and they keep getting voicemail. They send an email and they don't get a response. And what they need is a polite introduction from a trusted advisor. And we will work with and earnestly help that company go to market and also be accountable for supporting their technology. So a lot of times what I call them, these guys are mad scientists. This has to do with all the customized development. It's really a go-to-market service. They built a beautiful technology, but they are so in the weeds. Ask them to explain what their technology does, and it takes them 10 minutes. And you go, no. C-level executives are really busy. You have to narrow that down to a sentence. And it's hard for them to do that. It's hard for them to create like the marketing assets and the success stories because they're developing software. But what you need is not just the development of the software. What you need is an experienced ecosystem that can work with customers, support customers, build case studies, build success stories, promote those success stories, go to conferences for you. Like, conferences are expensive. You go to any conference out there, you're talking about $4,000 or $5,000 just for the exhibition space. And then you got to fly there and put two people on a hotel. And then you find out when you get to the conference, they charge you for electricity for the booth. It's like crazy. So now you're $10,000 in trying to sell your software package that maybe it costs $1,000 and maybe your margin is 20%. You're in startup mode. So you have to make $50,000 to pay back the investment of that conference. My company goes to conferences. We're already there. We would love to help represent your company and your elegant solution around the world. And I'm not in a parasitic relationship where we're going to give you money and then not give you help. We're going to give you help in return for a fair share of revenue that is equal to the fair share of revenue of the rest of your team. We're not going to ask for a parasitic portion. And there are there's not plenty of companies that will give you money. There's a couple of companies that will give you money in the AEC space, and then they'll let you hang yourself with the rope that they've knitted you. We want to create a healthy relationship with small developers and help them go to market. And that's the customized development and really build an ecosystem that is best of breed solutions. And I've just, you know, sort of accidentally gotten in this position because I was fortunate to get great relationships in the AEC space. But if a company built or is building an amazing tool for the construction space, and not just the amazing tool, that's not the trick, Devin. There are tons of amazing tools and the teams are flaky. You need to meet people that can do things when they say they're going to do it and be accountable. Because I tell you, a less amazing tool by an earnest team that can do things on time when they say they're going to do them, that tool wins. And we want to work with those teams. You know, BIM consulting around the design space, VDC coordination around the construction space. We do an enormous amount of project coordination for contractors on enormously large and complex projects. And then it's go-to-market services for software companies. And that's the three things that we're really, really about.
Phil, I just love your conversation because I look at myself in the mirror, and that's how you really have to scale and grow your business, is to say, for the past 15 years, I've been a student of the construction arena, beating my head against the wall, loving construction and technology and the construction silos that have been built up. So I have been going as a student, going to the International Builder Show for the past 5 years, going to Autodesk, CES, all these different places to go and learn and pull back this information so that I can be credible and have these great relationships to tell the story on the art of construction. And what you're talking about, at the end of the day, I've been talking about it since day one, my local window and door company, we call our sales reps trusted advisors. And we use our platform, we use windows and doors to sell our relationships. But that's the experience that we're creating at Mountain View Window and Door. And it is such a struggle as a business owner. I go all the way back to the beginning of when I'm cutting grass and running a lawn mowing company, is like trying to figure out what tools you use. If you confuse, you lose. And I'm doing a presentation at IBS. They asked me and the NAHB to do it for the 55 plus to say, how can you use a podcast for your business? And it's kind of ironic to say, like, now it's the cool thing, but now it's become mainstream. And that's the whole thing that I'm talking about is what you think you're best at. That's where podcasts can sometimes give you the most help. Where I think I'm really good at marketing, because that's what I went to college for, and that's what I've done. And my mantra has always been marketing, but I'm that mad scientist as well. And you have to look at the KISS model of keep it simple, stupid, in this crazy world of noise, of getting it down to one sentence. So I'm a big fan of Donald Miller's story brand. And I've never met him, but I've listened to all his podcasts. I mean, if I saw the dude in the airport, I'd run up and give him a hug, just like I probably will when I finally meet Bill and I meet him at Autodesk University. And I tell you that story, Tribe, is because you can just go to a conference and walk through. You can just say it's the cool thing to do and spend 10 grand for a booth, but you're going to not have a business if you don't build relationships.
You will quickly go out of business.
So
I totally agree.
And
they don't teach this at architecture school. And mind you, I studied architecture. I didn't study construction, but I actually worked in construction to put myself through college for a time. And I found out real quick, I don't like climbing under buildings. And that's just me. So I'm probably not going to be good at that. I love the design process. I love taking complex things that don't overlap and figuring out where they overlap. And I have observed an institutionalized arrogance in architectural schools that I don't know that it can be overcome. I don't know if the industry is going to eventually change in a very dramatic way, but the time and effort and the money to go to architecture school and then get out and not be able to solve problems and borrow an enormous sum of money to make $30,000 a year is just not tenable. It's not going to keep going that way. And, you know, if I can do anything to help the industry change for the better, and I think people have to be really careful, you know, as young people, we go, oh, we have all these great ideas. There are unintended consequences of just changing this little butterfly effect over here and then breaking a multi-million dollar construction project because you just thought it would be great to solve this one problem and you weren't looking at the big picture. Man, architecture school, I loved architecture school. I had a couple of amazing professors, but there's also this institutionalized arrogance against learning to use tools that help you solve problems. And that is exactly what you get paid to do when you get into the real world. Your business, whether it's windows or doors or anything, you're just trying to solve the customer's problem, which at a really high level, and I don't want this to sound trite, it is the absolutely crystal center of being a successful business person, is you're trying to give your customer a polite experience, a polite and memorable experience. Because when the next door comes along and it's $5 cheaper and the next window comes along and it's $5 cheaper, the customer doesn't remember the unintended consequence of them going with another company for a $5 cheaper door and going, you know what? I could ruin my project picking the wrong team. It's not about the technology. It's not about the door or the window. It's about the team. And if I call Devin and I go, Devin, I got a problem. And Devin goes, no, you don't have a problem. I'm going to fix it. You can't put a number on it. And so it's the crystal clarity of giving your customer a polite and memorable experience. And if you learn to do that when you're cutting grass and you're in college, you're golden. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but it means you don't have to sit at a cubicle and fill out forms by HR and, you know, and that whole large. You can be an entrepreneur. You can make better money than you're making now, and you have more flexibility. The thing that people don't realize when they're young, and I wish they would teach business at architecture school. I wish they could go, you're spending $60,000 a year to go to architecture school. What if you took $60,000 a year a decade ago and put it into Apple stock or Amazon stock? Like, they don't teach you to think in that kind of holistic way. If you can understand the importance of giving your customer, whatever it is, a polite and memorable experience, you'll be golden.
All right. This is where I would normally force myself to close this show out. But Phil, do you have a little bit more time? There's another squirrel hole I want to go down. So okay. If you need to hit pause, get a cup of coffee, or hit pause and listen to this on the drive home, because there's so much gold being talked about here. I'm going to open up, Phil and I, when we were doing our pre-interview discussion, we had a discussion about this thing called modular construction. And he
you're going to open up a can of worms.
I may challenge you a little bit on this. And I said, you know, I want to go
there. Good, good.
If you go back to show 86, I interviewed Audrey Grubesic, who, a great gal that I was very crusty about modular construction, because I had, right out of college, went to work for a modular company, and it was total BS. They were trying to just sell whatever the garbage they could have and make it a thing. And I went to their training school and all this kind of stuff. And so I was jaded. And in my presentation at IBS, I'm going to talk about this, is you think you know what you think you know, and you don't know what you don't know. And sometimes you have to be taught and educated on where it's going. And right now there's a massive disruption happening with companies like Katerra. That's a Silicon Valley startup that has crazy amounts of funds, and they're really changing and disrupting a lot about the construction arena. We did a whole 15 series on, we called System Build Lifestyle. And if you're interested, the Art of Construction Family Brands now is doing deep dive series. We're honored at at IBS, we're launching a series that we're working with Builder Trend. That's partnered with Art of Construction and learning to connect those dots. And I commend them for doing that. So what I want to talk with Phil about is, he's lived it on the AEC side. I've lived it on the construction side. What do you think about modular, system build, offsite construction? It's kind of like BIM and all your software. There's so many buzzwords being used that it's built somewhere and brought to the job site. That's much easier said than done. Let's open up the can of worms and have some fun.
Here's the thing with, it goes with not just modular construction. I'll go down the rabbit hole a little bit. So before I studied architecture, I went to seminary for 4.5 years and studied philosophy and literature. So I like to take an idea. I don't like using metaphors to argue, because I think that's the easy way out. But I like extracting the principle of the question that's being asked and see if we can answer it at a high level, because then we can apply it to lots of other things. So modular construction is a technical answer to an economic problem. And maybe that economic problem is, you're in a cold place and you have to build buildings year round. And it's hard to build buildings year round when it's cold, so you build them indoors. But let's step back and talk about technology, whether it's Microsoft Office or whether it's Revit or whether it's modular construction. The problem with technology is you can get ugly things fast. Okay. So I'll apply that to something like electric cars. I don't think electric cars have been successful until they're capable of teenage procreation. No 18-year-old guy wants to, or teenager wants to go out on a date in a Prius. It's not sexy. Now the Teslas came along, and those cars are sexy. I will refuse as much as I can to not cash out Apple stock to buy a Tesla. But the thing about Teslas is, they not only appeal to your economy. I mean, the equivalent of a full tank of gas, 300 miles in a Tesla, in North Carolina sets you back $7. Okay, that's a lot cheaper than a tank of gas. So it appeals to people's economy. Where Tesla has been successful and where modular homes have not been successful is, they don't appeal to people's sense of vanity. Now, I know people get all excited. I've got dear, dear friends who are tiny house enthusiasts, and they're modular construction enthusiasts. And the problem with answering all of those questions out in a factory is, it's a rifle shot. And if you get it wrong, the whole widget's wrong. And there's procurement challenges and there's transportation challenges. It's great if you build it somewhere else. And then you have the challenge of moving it on site. And most things that get built in the factory leave the factory when they're done getting built. And that makes it successful. So if you want to build big things in a factory, it's probably going to go into the water if it's a ship or a submarine. If it's an airplane, it's going to fly away from the factory. Getting buildings out of the factory and on site is not easy. And you have logistics issues because now instead of having a lot of small pieces and parts that people can move around and assemble at the last minute, you have a great big thing that requires, you know, significant logistics and planning. So if you don't get all of the planning perfect, it's like, to me, modular construction is a rifle. If you get the rifle pointed in the right direction and you pull the trigger, you hit the target. If you miss, you don't know where it's going. And then you spent an enormous sum of money getting teams together. You've built buildings to build buildings. And if you get that wrong, you have wasted an enormous sum of money. So what do we do in the marketplace to build houses? I know as much as modular housing is promoted and how it's going to be amazing. Number one, it's still expensive. Well, actually, it's not. North Carolina has a $5 billion modular housing industry. It's a mobile home industry. And you can buy a house for $30,000. As a matter of fact, if you design a house and take it to a manufacturer of mobile homes, they will build it for 50 cents on the dollar and you can sell it and you don't even have to be a registered architect. So if you want to build modular housing, go for it. I wouldn't cash out Apple stock to do it. But the challenge is there is an enormous amount of planning that has to occur to get it right. And you have to trust that all of that stuff is right in order to make it work. Or what you do is you hire local people and you break the building down into small assemblable parts. And yeah, it's a little more expensive. And yeah, some of them don't show up on time. And yeah, some of it's wasteful. But overall, it's financially predictable. It's going to make you money. Is it as efficient? No. But is it going to generate revenue and pay for everyone's effort? If you really look, if you want to get really dark about it, look at your tax bill for your house at the end of the year. And they break it up based on the building and based on the property. And your building, when you buy a house, the value of the building itself, the replacement cost of that, is it's inconsequential. You're really buying the value of the land. If you want to buy a modular house, go and get a mortgage application form. Just ask for a mortgage application form to get pre-approved. At the bottom of that form, it asks you what type of house you're buying. And if you're buying modular construction, it's a tick against you because modular construction is more, it's really more like an appliance or like a car. And cars and appliances depreciate, they devalue over time. Whereas the way that the industry is built up is homes are site built, they tend not to devalue over time. They tend to go up in value. Well, that's, you know, do you want to roll the dice and buy a modular home or a prefabricated home and then find out that it goes down in value over 20 years? That's the money that you might want to pass on to your next of kin. So there's just an enormous amount of complexity there. I get that they want to build micro apartments in New York. If I was any young person, I wouldn't live in a first tier city unless it was probably Singapore or Sydney. There's better places and better qualities of life. Micro apartments are great when you're single. You do want a quiet space as you get older. You've got kids. Bill has kids. You mentioned Bill before. You need a quiet place sometime. The thing is that they're beautiful, but they're like appliances. They do this one thing really, really well. And then outside of that, they're inflexible, right? Like what if you want to change the construction? You want to move a room around? You want to upgrade a modular home? You might find yourself in a bit of an unpredictable situation. So it either works completely or it really doesn't work. And the other thing with the smaller homes that concerns me is the expensive parts of the homes are your utility areas. So your kitchen areas, your bath areas, that's where a lot of money is spent. You build a small, tiny home of 1,000 square feet, you'll find out that the cost per square foot is not proportional in the same way it is to a 4,000 square foot house. And, you know, in America, we're not constrained by geography and certainly not in Charlotte. You can buy a 4,000 square foot house for $400,000. And if you take $400,000 and divide it by a mortgage payment, you go, well, if I put $50,000 down or $100,000 down, I finance $300,000. That's $600 a month for 30 years. In Charlotte, one person can make that much money a month to have money left over. The banks want to loan you know, two or three times your monthly income. If you got to pay a bill of $1,800 a month for your 4,000 square foot house, the bank says, well, do you make $4,000 a month? $4,000 a month, $50,000 a year? Yeah, you can make that in Charlotte. You can have a life. If you've got a partner, if you're married or have a partner, their income comes to it as well. So what people are trying to do with modular housing is not make just they're solving the problem of making things more efficiently to a higher quality of detail. They're not solving the big problem of how are you going to borrow money against it? How is the Department of Insurance going to consider it for insurance purposes? Is it going to go up in value over time? And I think sometimes architects are really myopic about, oh, if we just solve this one problem, we can make a business. It's like, no, you have to solve a multitude of problems. So that's my rant about modular tiny houses and why they're not successful. Ultimately, they're not successful because we've evolved as humans. The one thing that we're evolved to do primarily is reproduce. And if a modular home doesn't appeal to your vanity, I think at a very base and biological level that's millions of years old, you don't get to have a partner, you don't get to reproduce, you don't get to have kids because you've chosen poorly about your nest. And so that's why people don't buy it. It's a whole psychology thing. Like, it's just, people go, well, that's weird. It's idiosyncratic. If I buy that, am I going to find a partner? Do I get to, you know, continue my, you know, my species?
Awesome.
They haven't figured
awesome
that out.
Protected.
If modular housing, to make modular housing sexy, if Apple Computer did it, if Elon Musk decided to do it, who else? If Mercedes-Benz and BMW and Audi, if those companies got together to design something that not only satisfied the thing that appealed to people's vanity, but it appealed to people's economy in the sense of, like most of the modular homes that people design and get built, they just look like regular homes. They're just built in a factory. We used to do that with cars. When cars first came out, they looked like horseless carriages because that was the metaphor that we had for transportation. They were just carriages without horses. And then after a while, we went, you know what? Cars are kind of their own thing. We don't have to make them look like horseless carriages. I don't think we've turned that. We've turned the corner there with modular, you know, prefabricated housing. We're still making new houses look like old houses. If you made new houses that embedded the technology such that it collected energy, it collected water, it allowed people to be more earnest and connected to how they lived, and you built those in a neighborhood so people could figure it out together, like, okay, well, then you're changing, like, instead of just building a thing, you're building critical mass. And instead of building a neighborhood out in the middle of nowhere because it's cheaper and that recovers the cost of modular construction, you build them near cities where people really want to live, but give people the ability to be more self-determining. So the tough thing with houses in Devon is how people live is like, how do you get energy and water in, and how do you get waste and water out? If you can solve those kinds of problems and build a modular house and not only maintain the economy of how to do it well, but put it in a location where people can live around other people and then also appeal to the vanity of, like, as technologists, we would love to be more engaged with, like, instead of our houses just consuming energy to actually produce them. Give me those kinds of options, I'll buy a modular house. But right now, it's just new houses that look like old houses, and they just do the same kinds of things.
Good perspectives. And that's what I love, to have different insights and different people, because you have so many different aha moments, both sides of different perspectives. I run a presentation called The Full Life Perspective, and it's fascinating how fast you have to move sometimes and how much time you have to do the right thing, as my core values state. And you mentioned Tesla, and Elon Musk, his business plan is real simple. It's, what would this look like 10 years from now? And that's what he did with rockets and cars. In the construction arena, these silos have built up to where there's a lot of people that are calling the shots that are looking, and you need to look at the project right now versus how can things be in 10 years from now. And that's the part that you have to look at, those different things. And I massively believe that where technologies is going is why we're putting such a big impetus on interviewing people like Phil and his team of technology enthusiasts, that if people have been around and understand how you can take a tool like Enscape as a great tool, those are the tools in your toolbox that are not the hammers and the nails. That's where I think there's going to be a big paradigm shift when these tools get integrated properly. And that's the key of having people that have lived it, can massage this thing to make those tools in open collaboration. I see a lot of modular stuff where it's, this is our box and you have to work within our box. Well, you're going back to the same thing of crusty contractor saying everything has to go through me in the past. So you have to build that stuff and look at those different perspectives, because offsite construction is not going away. But when you really read the articles, it's not growing like you'd think it would because
no, and it's a bigger picture. I mean, like building things off site is a thing that exists. They're called factories and they build toasters and TVs and computers. They build things off site because you don't want someone, I think it was either Bucky Fuller or Frank Lloyd Wright. You know, you don't want people coming to your house to build a car. That's silly. They build it somewhere else and then they bring it to you. Houses are a different thing. You know what? Yeah, the crusty contractor, those guys have an enormous amount of experience about what's stupid. Like, you can learn how to use a hammer. It will take you decades to learn how not to use a hammer. And those old guys, the reason they're crusty is because they've seen people hurt themselves doing something silly with hammers and nail guns, and they want to steer clear of that. Sometimes the best thing to have is a crusty contractor. That guy doesn't want to be stressed out, and he wants to leave the job site at a regular hour. And if you can maintain a good business relationship with someone like that, you're golden. Because they really know how things can get fucked up in a construction project, and they're risk averse. You know, the biggest thing, Devin, if you go back to college and how you worked yourself through school, the value of doing that isn't that you have the flexibility to say yes. You have the ability to say no. And the importance of a business person, it's not just the ability to be able to say yes to things because you'll chase rainbows. You have to wisely learn when to say no. And the freedom of being able to say no when someone says, I want to pitch you this idea. I want you to come here. I want you to go there. I want you to fly over here. And if you work for a company and, you know, they're really paying your bills, you just have to do what they tell you. The freedom in life comes from the ability to say no. It's like, yep, you know what? I don't think that's interesting to my company. I like what you guys are doing, but we're not aligned. So let's just stay professionally. Let's just keep in touch and see if something gets interesting. You know, we'll have a chat the next quarter. But you don't have to do anything. You can say no. And the freedom of being able to say no is the most wonderful thing. It frees you up to do the things that you're interested in. And that's what people early on don't realize. They think if I just go to school, I'll borrow money. And then when I get out, they're going to pay me based on the money I'm borrowing. It's not going to happen. And then you can't say no. You're stuck.
That's gold. And the Tasmanian Devin here has to learn that. And that's what's been podcasting is so great, because when you listen back, you can't just talk and shove it down the throat. It's a one-way thing where you have to learn how to listen. And that's been gold for me, to where, you know, my original motto was just work harder than everybody else. That's total BS. Like, you have to work smarter than everybody is the
you have key. To learn to go read the biography of a guy named Bill Graham. Not the religious leader, Bill Graham, although I suppose you could read that too. He's probably an interesting guy. But Bill Graham, the record and rock band promoter, read the story of Bill Graham. That guy scrubbed the floors of his own concert halls. That guy made sure people, like, his customer experience was so critically important. But the one line that I took away from the story of Bill Graham was that he said, the problem with the artist is the artist always wants to say yes. And you need somebody who will say no. And that's who Bill Graham was. He would like look at a project and look at a proposal and go, yeah, we're not going to do this. Go and read Bill Graham's biography and learn about the value of saying no, because saying no means you probably dodged a bullet. You can't say yes to everyone. And the artist, and by the artist, I mean the architect, the musician, the artist, they want to say yes to everything. The musician will fill the tank with gas, drive to New York, perform, and hope they make enough money to drive back. They don't even know how they're going to get back. And the architect will work themselves out of business so quickly because they're artists. They want to perform. They don't know how to say no. And you have to learn how to say no, not impolitely. I don't even like to say no to customers. I'll like to say, you know what? I don't think this is a good fit right now. Let's revisit this in a quarter. I'm not saying no. I'm saying, let's just wait. Let's just think about it for a while. You will dodge an enormous amount of trouble learning to properly say no. And that's a really hard thing for the artist. Do. The artist wants to always say yes.
The art side of construction. That's, you know, the old motto of nothing happens till you sell something, but make sure you're teeing up what's good for you and good for your customer as being the trusted advisor. Because if you take on something you're not good at by saying yes to the wrong things, you're just burying yourself into a whole nother hole.
Yeah.
That is a whole nother problem when we talk about not having enough money, you know, time and money. That's the thing. You have to be really good at saying no. And I raise my hand here, Tribe. I really have to work hard on that. And that's where the podcast is, that big thing of no, no, no. It's kind of like, now that I run a podcast, I better make sure I record it. I've had a habit of doing that. So the first thing on my screen is a big thing. It says record, record, record.
Oh, you're good. Yeah.
So you have to understand those mantras. So to kind of wrap things up, of all these, the breadth of knowledge that you've built, what mistake do you see over and over again that you would say we need to really think about and learn from? Or
people don't listen. They don't fucking listen. Architects have amazing ideas about how things should be. And an architect, almost without exception, has never dug a hole. Go dig a hole. One day, just dig a hole. And then tomorrow have someone trivially, just casually say, I know we dug the hole over there. Let's dig the hole over here today. That's what an architect will do. An architect will say, I think we should put the hole over here. And then you're like, okay, let's get all the logistics together, get people together. And the last one, they go, you know what? I think we need to put the hole over there. Do you know what you do to people's spirit when you do that? Like, you're treating them like a commodity. And so you get a guy to show up who's trying to pay his bills, and he's put a credit card on the countertop at a Lowe's or a Home Depot, and he's bought a bundle of 2x4s, and you get that guy on site and you say, I want to put a wall up. And then the architect comes along and he says, you know what? I think we need to move the wall over there. You just nail gun together a bunch of 2x4s. And you know what you do to the guy's spirit when you do that? How you devalue him as a human? So what architects need to do is really shut the fuck up and go out and listen to the lies and the stories of how contractors have to put money on the line. You cut that piece of wood too small, you cut it the wrong size, and you have to set it to the side because you can't just throw it out. You're throwing out 10 bucks. You have to set it to the side out of the range so that you can come back and use it again. And I think the thing is for us in the technology space, we tend to trivialize change and the impact on what that does to people's spirit and psychology and their sense of purpose and their sense of meaning, that you just go out as an architect and go, well, I can make these changes at Revit. It should be trivial to go out and make those changes on site. And what you've done is just upset the logistics of how people have obligated themselves to be over here on this day and be back over here on that day. And it's all because we thought we had this great idea because it was in the computer. And I think we need to be really, really careful about that. That is the hardest thing. There's an enormous amount of books about how architects want to change things and make things better, and they've got a great idea. And then almost without exception, it gets, you know, when things get built and their great idea gets realized, it turns to shit. And they go, oh yeah, we didn't think about that.
Yeah, the construction side, right? Beginning with the end in mind. And that's
and respect those people. Those people, I know we kind of joke and say the curmudgeonly contractor. Those people have an enormous amount of experience. And they feel the sense of obligation, and they put money, they bought materials and supplies on credit in order to hope to pay that back based on the profit of their project. Margins are tight. You know, you can't treat them as a trivial commodity. That's a really hard thing. And I think what's going to happen to architects, and it's only being constrained, the dam of water is being held back because of legal paper, and that dam is going to bust. If you want to build a car in Japan, there's companies that build cars in Japan. Those same companies have construction firms, and those construction firms employ designers and architects. And that hasn't happened in North America because you know, at one time the AIA wanted to sue John Portman because John Portman was a developer architect. And they said, no, we're going to sue you. You can't be in the AIA. You have to choose. Are you going to design it or are you going to develop and build it? And he was like, no, I'm going to do both. And they fought him tooth and nail. And when he passed away last year, they celebrated him. That's how old and weird the AIA can be at times. When construction firms, and there's going to be some compression around this, when construction firms can own architects, they employ them. No different than if I want to go buy a car or a computer or a toaster, I don't go and hire a designer of a computer and then ask somebody to go and build it. I just go and buy the thing. And contractors, I think in the next decade or two, they're going to be able to employ designers and architects. And it's going to positively impact the pipeline of designing buildings because there's going to be an accountability very early in the process that we don't get now. A lot of times architects, you know, in a very impolite way of saying it, we impose our designs on the contractors and we have to, you know, re-educate them and we have to ask them to risk their, that's why architects charge for time and contractors charge for construction. And if there's money left over at the end of construction, if the contractor's smart, they get to, you know, they've arranged a contract where they get to keep that money. Whereas the architect says, I'm going to do it for this many hours. And then they're trying to figure out at the end how to stop working because they can't stop working. But when contractors, when the people that build buildings are able to employ the people that design them, I think we'll be in a much better condition. Of course, there's going to be edge conditions. We'll be in a much better situation because that's how everything else works. When you buy a car, the company employs the team that designs and engineers and manufactures the car. I'm just going to buy the car. I just want to go and buy the appliance. I just want to go and buy the building. And right now those teams are divergent and they have to be legally separated, and it creates a lot of unnecessary stress and a lot of wasted revenue, because, you know, you're working the next time another project comes along, it's a new contractor, it's a new engineering firm. Why do I want to keep doing that? I want to keep working with the same team. And we do it artificially now, but I think ultimately what's going to happen is contractors are going to be able to employ you'll just work for a contractor, but you'll be an architect.
Yeah,
sounds crazy. Let's see what happens.
Design build world, right? I love your comment.
I don't even think it's going to be design build. I think it's like in Japan, when I first started implementing Revit in Japan, I had to shut up and listen because it was different. The architects don't do construction documents. They're working for a contractor. And I asked a contractor, they're like, yeah, here's our team that does CDs. And so what we were trying to figure out in the spring of 2004 was, how do we transition this model from the design team to the contractor? And they said, well, we actually have a lot of our own designers. We can design houses and manufacture houses. I think Honda and Toyota do it in Japan. The interesting thing to me was when they were using outside designers, they did the construction documents. So we were trying to figure out in Revit, how do we transition or at least have this kind of, there was no work shared files. There was no BIM 360 cloud. And so it was like, I'm trying to figure out, is it going to be this transition where the design calcifies and then the whole Revit project goes over to the contractor? Because the contractors do the construction documents and they do them beautifully. And it confused me. Like, you guys are doing CDs? Why would you do that? And they questioned me. It's like, we're going to put the building together. Why would we not create the instructions of how the building's going to be put together? Why would someone else do that? We're going to do that. So that's how it happens in Korea and in Japan and Hong Kong. Contractors do CDs.
They get the design
and they finish them. So, and the contractors can employ architects or people that fulfill the role of people that design buildings. And we're not allowed to do that legally in the U.S. And I think that's going to change. And it'll be a change for the better.
Yeah, that's interesting. In today's world, art is charging for the time and the construction is charging for the execution. And that's tough when you're passing the paper and the 2x4 back and forth. Right.
Well, and it's tough if you don't get paid, because if you're the architect, how do you go back and get your paper? How do you go back and get your intellectual property? If you're a contractor and you're not getting paid, you know what you do is you say, I'm going to have to take all my stuff off site and I'm going to put a lock on the site and I'm going to lean against your property. I bet you they get paid first.
Yeah, that's gold. Yeah, I'm a big fan of learning a lot about when going to the podcast with Evolve Lab where we talk about computational design. I've been blown away learning about these tools like Grasshopper and these different tools that can put that stuff together, but you still have to make that stuff work. And it'll be fascinating to see where the art of construction, where the art and the construction changes. So awesome stuff. I could listen and, so much information that you've given. What's your crystal ball for the future with technology and construction?
The construction firms are going to own architecture firms. They will just, like, a big construction firm will buy a big acronym firm. You could just, the acronym firms, HOK, SOM, RTKL, they're acronym firms. A construction firm is going to buy a high design firm and they're going to build buildings. That's my crystal ball for the future. The technology, I think, is Revit is as old as AutoCAD was when we first started using Revit. The technology is going to change. You still need to use to learn the tool, but don't be afraid to be interested and curious in what else is out there. And a small team can work circles around a big company. I talked to a CIO at an acronym firm in New York recently and said, what keeps you up at night? And he said, we used to lose projects to medium-sized firms that I'd heard of, right? They're pursuing work. They lose a project to some medium-sized firm that they compete against. And here they are, this firm does big, beautiful buildings around the world. And he goes, yeah, we used to lose projects to these smaller firms that I'd heard of. He goes, the thing that keeps me up now is we lose projects to small teams I've never heard of. And that's what technology will allow you to do. But ultimately, Devin, it's not about the technology. What those firms are actually doing that's allowing them to win work is they're giving their customer a polite and memorable experience.
Awesome, man.
That's why they're winning work.
Thanks so much for coming and telling your story. If there's one thing for contractors and its affiliates to grow their business, or maybe you're going to regurgitate it one more time, because as I say, you got to say it 7 times before they hear it for the first time. What's that one thing you want to leave them with your experience to help contractors and affiliates grow their business?
look, the contracting space is being imposed upon by the design and engineering space. If a contractor wants to build your, if you want to build your business as a contractor, don't work with bozos. That's the biggest thing. It's not about the technology. The architect that you work with, if that guy ever stops showing up on time, if he starts making excuses, don't work with him. If that engineering firm can't get their shit done when they say they're going to do it and they're holding up your team, don't work with them. If you want to grow your business, pick the best people on the team. That'll keep you golden. And if you don't, like the contractors that have people standing around a hole waiting for instructions because something has changed, because somebody else treated the decision in a casual and impolite way, don't ever, ever, ever work with that team. If you're working with an architecture firm and the bozo from the other firm moves to that new firm, question about whether or not you want to work with that guy if he works with that new team. Learn to say no. That's the only way to build your business, because you're putting your entire financial future at stake depending on people that can't get their shit done on time. Don't ever, ever do that. Just run in the opposite direction.
Awesome. Thanks so much, man, for coming in and telling us your story.
All right, buddy. Thanks, Devin. Have a great day.
So much gold. The conclusion is short. Subscribe, check it out, stay in touch. With people like Phil joining the AOC tribe, we have so much great information coming down the pike. Thanks for listening, sticking in there. Hopefully you got so much great information to help you grow your business. Crush it out there, AOC community.